Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Drive Nation podcast, now on episode 5. We're still doing this over Skype from our homes and still concentrating on standalone special episodes. I'm Dan Prosser, joined once again by my co-founder and co-host, Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Dan. How are you? How are you surviving all this nonsense?
Surviving, quite happy, really, but it's just a bit tedious now, isn't it? And worrying as well, I suppose, from a sort of professional point of view for all of us.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think it's one of those things, I think like so many people, it's just the quantifying the problem, isn't it? If you knew how long it was going to last, you could plan. But anyway, you, like me, are in an awful lot better position than lots of people, so we should probably stop whinging and get on with our podcast.
Exactly right. So for this one, we're talking all about Aston Martin. I've subtitled this The Highs and the Lows.
The many highs and the many lows.
Exactly. And the company was founded in 1913, which meant in 2013 it celebrated its 100th year, its centenary. So we're now in its 108th year. Andrew, off the top of your head, in how many of those years has Aston Martin turned a profit?
Oh, blimey. You keep on throwing these curveballs at me. And I suspect that everybody out there thinks that these are carefully, you know, rehearsed bits that we do. We really don't. I never know what question Dan's going to ask me first. How many of that? Some, but really very few. Hopefully some of the more recent ones. I mean, you know, there was a long period where they didn't even know how much it cost them to make a car and didn't realise that the cost they were selling them for was rather less than the cost they were making them for. I don't think they ever made any profit pre-war. I mean, I think probably in the late 50s and early 60s, DB4s, DB5s, James Bond, all that, they probably made a bit. And I think in the Ford era they did. And obviously recently, until the fairly calamitous 2019 that they had, I think the numbers were pointing in the right direction. So, I mean, definitely not never, but rather more rarely than would be described as being optimal for the car industry or indeed any other industry.
It's funny, isn't it? Here's a company that's well into its 11th decade, and it's turned a profit in a handful of years throughout that time. We won't put a number on it, but it's not a huge amount. And yet it's still there. It's still got an incredible reputation around the world. The brand is enormously strong. And yet it's proved so difficult over the years to turn it into a sustainable business. I don't believe in curses or witchcraft or any of that stuff. But Aston's performance over the years, it kind of makes you wonder, is there something cursed about this brand?
Well, I mean, you can look at it the other way, can't you? Yeah, however difficult it has been for Aston Martin to make a profit, it's been even more difficult for someone to kill it. Because despite all that's gone on, and who knows how many times it's gone bust over the years. I mean, it first went bust in 1925. And you know, and it's been going bust with reasonable regularity. I'm not going to say ever since, because it hasn't in the very modern era, because it's had some fairly big patrons behind it. But you know, nevertheless, here we are. And so many other brands have come and they've gone. and have suffered, you know, you would think, you know, less trouble than Aston Martin and not survive it. And this is what, to me, brings me back to the power of the brand. It is such a name, isn't it? You know, and the thing is that because it is that name, because it is, I don't want to use the word, but it has a certain sort of iconic status, that someone will always want to rescue it. Someone will always want to be the person who digs at Aston Martin out of whatever hole it's just dug for itself again. And, you know, and to mix my metaphors furiously, you know, allows it to set sail for some new bright horizon. And long may that continue.
It was probably only 12, 18 months ago that I was quite gladly talking about Aston Martin as being perhaps the most exciting luxury car brand on the planet, just because of everything that it had going on. It was bringing the Valkyrie to market. So Aston Martin was having its own McLaren F1 moment, and that car is actually just around the corner. And then just beyond that car, there was a new range of mid-engine hypercars and supercars. The front-engine cars, the DBS Superleggera, the DB11 and the Vantage, really, really good cars. And then there was the DBX, which we all thought was going to prop the company up for a long time to come. Perhaps it will. There was racing activity. The Valkyrie was going to race at Le Mans. There were lots of incredible continuation cars, things like the DB4 GT Zagato. The brand had all this incredible stuff going on around it. And it just looked like the company was unrecognizable from the one that it had been only a few years previously. It was the sunlit uplands. And yet in the past few months, the past couple of years, the mood has kind of changed. I mean, the stock price it's really crashed. I haven't checked what it is recently, but it's slipped so far from that IPO.
Well, the IPO was at £19. And the last time I looked, it was less than one. It was about 85p a share. Now, I mean, obviously, a lot of that's got to do with, you know, global issues, which far outstrip any of Aston Martin's problems. But yeah.
So there are some very serious financial issues going on, and it's just been saved once again by a very wealthy backer in Lawrence Stroll and his investors. So where April 2020, what state is Aston Martin in? I mean, I thought it was just going to be sunshine and lollipops from here on, but it doesn't look that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think perhaps it might be instructive just to have a look at how it got into that state. And, you know, I don't know anything, but, you know, I think like all of us, we have opinions and we have ideas. And I think that a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is genuine bad luck. I think obviously the uncertainty over Brexit, the state of the pound, the collapse of demand for those sorts of cars in China, you know, all hit Aston Martin very hard. And if that had been, you know, a Bentley or a Rolls-Royce, you know, they could look to their, you know, massive global conglomerate owners, you know, BMW or Volkswagen. And, you know, when you're sheltering under a shield like that, you know, it makes weathering those sorts of problems, you know, massively easier. Now, Aston Martin, I mean, admirably, I guess, has always tried to be an independent, or certainly has in recent years since it was sold by Ford. But clearly that comes with associated risks. I think the other thing is, I think the business plan in terms of the models was actually looking pretty good. And I think there is an awful lot of exciting stuff. But you know, as we have seen in the history of Aston Martin, its ambitions tend to outstrip its resources. And, you know, and in the past, we have seen Aston Martin trying to do too much with too little. And it's fine so long as everything goes according to plan. But the problem is when things completely beyond your control turn against you, you haven't got that strength in depth, you haven't got those foundations, you haven't got that comforting arm around your shoulder you know, of your Volkswagen, and you know, things can turn quite bad quite quickly, and we've seen it before, and I think that's what we're looking at now. So you know, going forward, you know, I think there are things that I worry about. You know, there's the fact that there is no hybrid for some years to come in the DBX, when I think quite clearly that is going to be the sort of powertrain that people are going to want, is a concern. But fundamentally, I think the strategy of, you know, really cutting production down, making it a proper exclusive brand again, not chasing the volume, maintaining the residuals, and making, you know, really focusing on small numbers of very, very special cars has to be the right way forward for it. And I'm glad that that is certainly appears to be what they're going to try to do.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the future. Let's look backwards, Andrew. And can you? I know all this stuff is rattling around in your mind anyway. I just need to wring it out. Can you give us a bit of a breakdown of the ownership of Aston Martin? Maybe some of the highlights from over the years.
Yeah, no chance at all. I mean, you could write a book on it. In fact, I did. I did write a book about Aston Martin a couple of years ago, a massive thing, in which I went into all of this. And because I've needed the space in my brain for so much other stuff since then, an awful lot of it's gone out again. But, I mean, yeah, so it was started by Lionel Martin and Robert Bamford in 1913. Bamford left almost immediately. Martin hung around until 1925, until it went bust for the first time, by which stage I don't think they produced 60 cars in the first 12 years of production. Now, OK, yeah, I think all the Great War got in the way, but even so, that's not an awful lot of output, so you might not be too surprised that it went bust after that. Then, until the war, or close to it, it was down to a bloke called Augustus Bertelli, known as Bert, who was an Italian, but he came to Wales as a kid. So he's a bloke with an Italian name who spoke with a Welsh accent, and was known as Bert to everyone. And he was the bloke who kind of put Aston Martin on the map. He was the bloke who came up with all those great pre-war cars like the International and the Ulsters and the Mark IIs and so on. Then a bloke called Sir Arthur Sutherland had it, and, you know, took it up to the war and then immediately thereafter, but he realised that he wouldn't be able to finance it the way it needed to be financed, and sold it to David Brown. David Brown realised that they had a really good chassis and a car that they made a prototype called the Atom, but they didn't have an engine for it. So he bought Lagonda, where W.O. Bentley had designed a rather nice 2.6-litre twin-cam straight-six motor, and he stuck one in the other and came up with a thing called the DB2. DB2 prototype form came out in 1949, went on sale, I think, 1950, and that, I guess, is the start point. That's the, you know, that's the starting pistol for all of Aston Martin. And then you sort of wander through the 1950s, which was... Yeah, it was a lot about DB2s, but it was also an awful lot about motor racing. You know, they had a 10-year campaign under John Wyre to try and win Le Mans, and they did it absolutely at the last gasp in 1959, and won the World Sports Car Championship that year as well. That was also the year in which they moved from Felton to Newport Pagnell and produced the DB4. And then after that, I think we kind of know, don't we? You know, DB456, DBS, V8 engines, and then it all went really fairly grim in the 1970s, you know, for lots of businesses, not just Aston Martin. And then it was really just a case of survival. Went into the era of Pace Petroleum, Peter Levanos, Victor Gauntlet being the chairman. He once told me that he went to work on two separate occasions expecting to shut the factory gates for good before the end of the day. He also told me a wonderful story about how Saddam Hussein saved Aston Martin.
Right. Go on.
Okay. So when Aston Martin was absolutely at its lowest ebb, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and rather conveniently burned the entire fleet of Aston Martin Lagondas that the Kuwaiti royal family had. And it was, once he'd been kicked out, it was the order to replace those cars, which for those few, whatever it was, days, weeks, months, kept Aston Martin afloat. So Victor was always quite grateful, Saddam, for, if nothing else, for doing that. But Victor realised, like others before him, that, you know, Aston Martin's future needed to be in the hands of a large organisation. And he was the person who did the deal with Ford. He didn't conceived the DB7, which was the car that has been, you know, regarded as the saviour of Aston Martin, although he had the idea for what he described as a new DB4. But then Ford came in, DB7 came along. You know, back then, you know, Ford weren't at all sure about Aston Martin. There were Ford executives in America who actually thought that the company was called Austin Martin. They knew so little about it. And, you know, the DB7 was their one roll of the dice. Had that not worked, that would have been the end of it. You know, Ford would have absolutely shut it, but the DB7, as we know, did work. it made Ford invest big time, built the Gaydon factory, DB9, early bets, modern era, off you go.
Wow. That was just off the top of your head, was it? I know you weren't reading from anything there.
No. Sad, isn't it?
That was quite a performance. Okay. And I remember you writing a piece for Drive Nation. If you haven't seen it, everyone, that's at @DriveNation_ on Instagram. It's a digital car magazine that lives just on Instagram. Please have a look. Andrew, you wrote a piece about Aston Martin. It was basically about the hilarious names of its occupiers over the years. Can you give us five of the best?
Oh, dear. Yeah, probably can't anymore. Lady Dorothea Charnwood was one. There was a bloke called Lance Prideaux Brune. Yeah, I mean, Bert Bertelli probably isn't that funny.
There was a count, was there?
Oh, Count Louis Zabrowski. Yeah, absolutely. He was mad. He was the bloke who came up with the original Chitty Chitty Bang Bangs, although they were known as Chitty Bang Bangs back then. But he would produce the aero engine racing cars. In fact, I think he might have been killed in one. But you know, he was the bloke who made the cars, which inspired the film. And you know, and the rest of that is history. So yeah, a few of them, a few strange people. But you know, so many people, none of whom really made any money out of it, just went leaping to Aston Martin's rescue because it just kind of felt like the right thing to do. I don't think that any of these people. I think it's almost like a sort of bloodhound, and Ian Warhurst coming in. He just, you know, whether, you know, it made him money, which I'm sure it won't, you know, he just saw a greater good, a nobler cause, and just felt that, you know, while he could save it, then he should. And I think so many people have felt that about Aston Martin. And, you know, and that explains how it's managed to endure through thick and thin, you know, all these years.
In the last couple of years, and certainly over the years to come, our preconception of what an Aston Martin is has been challenged, and it will be challenged even more. But if we go back, say, a decade, I think we all had a much clearer idea of what it was that made an Aston Martin an Aston Martin. So can we pretend we're recording this in 2010 and I've asked you that question? What are the core attributes?
Well, I mean, they sort of said it themselves, didn't they? I mean, I know this is an Ulli Betts era quote, and I know that everybody is not Ulli's greatest fan, but power, beauty, soul, that was the sort of, those were the catchwords, weren't they? That's actually what used to, you know, flash up on your dashboard when you stuck your key in and pressed the button and fired up your Aston Martin. What is an Aston Martin? Aston Martin is a driver's GT. It is a grand touring car, but not like, I mean, there's a balance, isn't there? I mean, you can describe a Bentley Continental GT as a grand touring car, but that's a car, I would say, where the element is, where the emphasis, sorry, is very much on the touring side of it. And the luxury and the refinement and the comfort, whereas an Aston Martin is on the other side of that equation. It's a driver's car. It's good enough to get you where you want to go. It's a great car to do a distance in, but when you get there, it's got to deliver. That to me has always been what an Aston Martin should be. That's why I've always loved the Aston Martins from the 1950s. People don't really talk about 50s Aston Martins, the DB2s and that sort of thing, but they really were. I really can't say this these days, but I mean it in its historical context. They were gentlemen's sports cars. They were beautifully crafted, hand-built cars. But they were very sporting in nature. And they had a character which was so important, to the development of how we think of the company today. And, you know, cars like the DB4, 5 and 6 are the sort of legendary cars, the Newport Pagnell cars of the 1960s. And they're the cars which became much more the sort of traditional grand tourers. But for me, for all they added, I think they also lost a little bit because they weren't, to be honest with you, they weren't great driving machines. And I think, to be honest with you, I think Aston Martin has produced many more great driving machines in recent years than they did back there in the years in which they made their name.
Okay, so that gives some idea of what an Aston Martin was like, what it was all about for the first sort of century or so. But in the last couple of years, and in years to come, an Aston Martin can be a mid-engine hypercar. It can soon be a mid-engine supercar. It can be an SUV. We're starting to see all these different sort of interpretations of what an Aston Martin might be. Do you think those attributes, those old Aston Martin attributes, can just be transposed onto a more focused sort of mid-engine car? Or are Aston Martin really going to have to get us to think about what its product should be in a different way?
I mean, I think the example to look at here is Porsche, isn't it? You know, Porsche, for whatever it was, the first 50 years of its life, made nothing but, you know, two-door lightweight coupes. And then suddenly out of nowhere, it produces this thing called a Cayenne. And, you know, we all threw up our arms in horror. I certainly did. And said, this is the end of the world and everything else. But of course, what I failed to appreciate at the time was the way that cars that had nothing whatever to do with Porsche's heritage were able to preserve it in the future. Because, you know, and I've said this before, you know, it is cars like the 911 which made people buy Cayennes, and it is cars like the Cayenne which provided the profits to allow Porsche to continue to develop the 911 and create, making, you know, and continue to make the really nutty stuff that we still love today. And I think that's got to be the strategy with Aston Martin. I mean, the DBX is, you know, Aston Martin say, oh, you know, they built a prototype SUV back in the 50s and, you know, 60s. I'm not sure that they did, but, you know, the DBX, you know, there is no proper SUV heritage within Aston Martin, but it worked for Porsche. And, you know, and my view is, you know, I'm quite, what's the word, cavalier about it. You know, if the DBX is a raging success, and I understand they're sold out at least until the end of this year, and that provides profits, which then allows them to do great driving cars, then, you know, I don't have a problem with that. And I also don't have a problem with the mid-engine thing. You know, I don't think a mid-engine car has to be, you know, rough and ready and raw. You know, it could be, I'm not putting up this up as a particular example of excellence, particularly not today, but an Audi R8 is a, you know, is a long distance touring mid-engine car, and I don't see why Aston Martin can't put their own spin on that sort of thing and be true to its values. I mean, I guess what will be interesting is what happens long term to the, you know, the traditional front engine, big engine coupes, you know, the DB11 and the DBS. Is there going to be a place for those sorts of cars in Aston Martin's future? You'd say that there should be, because Aston Martin has never not made a car like that. But then you've got to look at the market. If they go over to a mid-engine platform, are they also going to have a front-engine platform? Obviously the SUV platform, you know, for such a tiny company, is that a sensible strategy? It's, you know, if you look at McLaren, they have one platform and they produce everything off it. And they've been criticized for that too, and probably rightly so. So where is the sort of happy middle ground for a company, you know, producing, you know, a few thousand cars a year? I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how they play that.
Do you have a sense of why Aston Martin is going down the mid-engine route? Is it?
Yeah, I have a very good sense of why that is. Where the money is. It's as simple as that. You know, if you look at McLaren, Ferrari, Lamborghini, if you look at the, you know, the ultra high luxury sector, you know, there are a very, very small number of, you know, ultra luxurious cars, and I'm really talking Rolls Royces now, particularly as Bentley don't make a Mulsanne anymore. And then you've got mid-engine sports cars. You know, there really isn't, you know, anything else which will sell in the numbers that you require to make the money that you need to keep a business like that alive. And, you know, you can say, well, it's a purist thing and that's just the best engineering solution for that kind of car. And it probably is. But, you know, I also am certain that, you know, if it wasn't where the money was, Aston Martin wouldn't be doing it.
Okay, so we're talking about, that's why Aston Martin is pursuing the mid-engine thing, because that's where the profit is to be made.
And these cars, sorry to interrupt you. I mean, these cars, you know, if you look at the three mid-engine things that Aston Martin has done or are doing, there's obviously Valkyrie, then there's Valhalla, but, you know, going on at the same time is Formula One. That's all part of the same strategy. It's all because you can't just go steaming in and go, here's a, you know, here's a 488 720S rival, you know, enjoy. You've got to establish some credentials in the field to begin with, which is why Aston Martin has gone for these very, very, you know, exclusive high price, you know, hypercars, as a way of, you know, paving the way for the Vanquish, which will be the mainstream mid-engine car whenever it comes in. What are we looking at, 2022 for that, I think?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, so we've got these mid-engine cars on the way. Nobody outside the company or affiliated with the company has driven the Valkyrie yet, but we're willing to bet it's a fairly stunning machine. And I mean, I'm sure we're all hoping as well that the Valhalla and eventually the new Vanquish are incredible cars as well. But Andrew, looking back, what have been the standout Aston Martin models from over the years? I mean, there are plenty to choose from.
Yeah, hopefully we'll talk about Valk in a minute, because I think it's an important car, not just to Aston Martin, but to cars in general. But going back, I mean, the important ones, I think, are quite obvious. There's, there's DB2, which was, the car that set the ball rolling. There was DB4, which, you might say is the car that really, when people think of an Aston Martin, okay, they probably think of a DB5, but, that was started 2 years earlier by the DB4. Then there was the DB7, which saved the company. Those are the cars which are the most important Aston Martins. If, however, you were to ask me which were the best Aston Martins, which were the cars that, the Aston Martins that I've most enjoyed driving, it wouldn't be any of them. It would be a DB24 Mark III from the 1950s, or it would be a V12S Vantage from, a couple of years back. And it's those sort of slightly more niche cars, which are kind of ultimate derivatives of things they've been making for quite a long time, when they've really, really got their stuff together and have got to that stage where the mainstream models have kind of been done and they just want some really special stuff. Those are the Aston Martins which I remember most.
You haven't even mentioned the Oscar India.
The Oscar, the October introduction. Well, yeah, I should have done that. I mean, not just the Oscar India, but if people don't know what an Oscar India is, and goodness knows I didn't until not that long ago, these are the V8 Vantages that were produced from, I think it was October 1978. Someone will call in and tell me I'm wrong, but they weren't the very first of the V8 Vantages, but they were the ones which were improved. They'd sorted out the production a bit, and they're regarded as being the sort of the optimal versions of those cars. And yeah, and they are incredibly cool cars. I can remember as a kid reading tests of those cars, and just the fact that people would get a Lamborghini Countach and a Ferrari Boxer and a Porsche 911 Turbo and put an Aston Martin V8 Vantage in, I was just so proud that the car was even in there. And yeah, they're magnificent thing. But again, not the start of anything, the end of something. I mean, that was the end of the V8 era. And until you start getting into, terrible things like Virages. So again, it is another car that follows that theme of being at the end of a development cycle or towards the end of a development cycle rather than at the beginning of it.
And so in the last couple of years, the company, which had, it could have carried on building the front engine GT cars that it was very good at building, that it had been learning how to craft for several decades, but it's really been stretching itself over the last couple of years with this Valkyrie project in partnership with Red Bull Racing. It's a stunning machine, partly to look at, but also the numbers and the technology involved. It really does feel like it's a game changer for the hypercar sector. How significant is it?
Well, I guess we have to wait to see until we or someone gets to drive it. Hopefully me, but who can see? Who can tell? I'm old enough to remember being at this stage before the McLaren F1 came out. And all the indications then, as are all the indications now, is that that was, and this is going to be, as you say, a game-changing car. Now, you might say, well, it's impossibly expensive. They're only making a handful of them. It's an irrelevance. It doesn't matter. And to almost everybody, almost everywhere, I guess that's true. But to those of us who love cars, love the industry, love the technology, love progress, it's just, even if it's academically fascinating, it doesn't make it any less fascinating for that. And I think that cars, I think anything really, which does stuff that's never been done before, and I don't think there's any doubt at all that the Valkyrie will do stuff that nothing which has ever been entitled to wear a number plate has done before. It will do those things. I think it will be, in terms of how we perceive what a car is capable of within the road car arena, I think it will be something completely different. I think it will be, you know, the same step that the McLaren F1 made. And, you know, and the fact that, you know, Gordon Murray was behind that car and Adrian Newey is behind this car, you know, that is not a coincidence. You know, you're talking about the finest Formula One car designers of their eras, you know, applying their, you know, their Brighton-sized brains to the business of creating a hypercar. And that's what you get.
It seems like it's going to be a sensational car. I just hope one day I get to drive one. It's a long shot, but, well, you never know, do you? Perhaps that will turn out to be the most memorable Aston Martin drive I've ever had. But for now, it's a very different kind of Aston Martin. Andrew, I'm going to ask you
It's a Scenic, isn't it?
It's not a Toyota IQ. No, it's... the Vantage N430. I want your answer to this question soon, Andrew, but I'm going to tell you mine first. It was a strange car, the Vantage N430, because this was in Aston Martin's wilderness years, really. If you talk to the guys there now, they'll tell you that they remember going to Geneva and unveiling what was essentially a sticker set for the V8 Vantage. That was all they had to show. And the car was several years old at that point. They'd done a little bit of fine-tuning here and there. They'd apparently squeezed a tiny bit more power out of it so that they could call it N430. But actually, it turned out to be a really stunning car. I remember being in the Scottish Borders on an Evo magazine photo shoot, and I'd been driving this Aston Martin. And it's a recalcitrant, kind of tricky car at low speeds. The fly-off handbrake is a pain. The clutch pedal is heavy. The steering feels heavy. It's a sort of obstructive thing to drive just at low speed. But then you pick up the speed a little bit on an open, flowing B road, and it all just comes together. I think in the past I've described speed for the Vantage N430 as being like a conductor for the orchestra. It all just comes together and it suddenly starts to make sense. And I remember driving along this Scottish Borders road and just getting into a flow with this car in a way that I haven't done with many cars before or since. And driving it in such a way that I could feel through every corner I was using just about all the front end grip, and then the car was settling on the rear on the way through. The body was just rolling a little bit into the corner. I was in tune with the gearbox and the engine and just flowing with this car. And it was one of those sort of out-of-body experiences where you get out and you actually don't remember consciously doing anything. And you just think, how the hell have I ended up here? And that, even now, when I sit back and think about my best ever drive in an Aston Martin, it's that N430. Andrew, you're going to tell me now that you think it's a terrible car and I've got no taste whatsoever.
No, I'm not. I'm going to tell you quite the reverse, actually. I think the N430 and I think all those, all that generation of Vantage were really, really good cars. So much so that I think if we keep it within the road car arena, I'd go for a very similar car. The original V12 Vantage, I can remember doing a job for Autocar where we decided to visit as many places of significance to the British motor industry in the UK as we could within whatever it was, 24, 48 hours. Can't remember. It was a while back. And we were, it was all a bit frustrating and a bit disappointing because, you know, these places didn't tend to locate themselves at the end of particularly good driving roads. They were factories and there were test tracks and that sort of thing. And we were just, you know, running around the countryside looking at these places. And we ended up in North Wales, I think maybe at the beach where Maurice Wilks first sketched out the original drawing for the Land Rover in 1947 or whenever it was. But anyway, what I do know is that we had to be at Pendine Sands at dawn the following morning.
In South Wales.
In South Wales. So I was at completely the wrong end of the country. And so I can't even remember which photographer it was, I'm sorry. So if they're listening to this, I apologise. But whoever it was a very good sleeper because we got up hours before dawn and I got in this car and drove it the length of Wales. And he slept, or certainly pretended to sleep, or was maybe just trying to sleep through the whole thing. And it was just one, nothing particularly dramatic happened. I wasn't driving like an idiot, but it was what you were talking about. It was just one of those occasions where you felt that you could you know, for once, use the performance of a car like that. And because they got everything so, the way those cars steered, the way they sounded, the pedal weights, all the control weights, in fact, yeah. all seemed to be related to each other. It was never, you know, it was never the fastest car on the straight line or the grippiest car through the corner. It would never, you know, have the best brakes or whatever. But taken as a whole, on the public road where those things just don't really matter very much, I can remember just sitting there and thinking, I'm completely knackered. I've got a full day shoot ahead of me. It's the middle of the bloody night. I should be fast asleep, and I couldn't be happier. I was just having a ball. And that, I guess, to me, is what an Aston Martin should make its owner or driver feel at all times. And it was, yeah, it's just one of those drives that has, you know, I've done thousands of those sorts of drives over my life, but it's just one that has really, really stuck with me because it was one of those drives where the car just, it just didn't get a damn thing wrong. It was fantastic.
Yeah, V12 Vantage. So the first one from just over a decade ago, wasn't it? I remember that car very fondly. I was new to the game back then. And I remember driving out to the N24, the Nürburgring, in, I guess that was May 2009, to collect this V12 Vantage and driving it back to the UK and just thinking it was a stunning machine. I adored it, and that engine in particular was sensational. And I have to tell you this story just because it still makes me laugh. I was working for a magazine at that time, and it was towards the end of the year. I guess it was probably September or October. We did one of those end of year, you know, group test car of the year things in North Wales. And I remember watching one of the other guys doing a cornering shot in the V12 Vantage around, it was actually through a junction. It was a slidey shot through a junction rather than a tight corner. And I remember it rotating through the corner, and then it just sort of carried on rotating. Then it rotated a bit more until it was broadside coming in my direction. I was in a safe spot, thankfully, and it didn't straighten up again. I just remember watching it nose quite heavily into this drainage ditch. So it was at this bizarre angle with its rear end poking right up in the air. The driver a little bit shell-shocked when he got out. And we had to drag it out using one of the other cars, a Jaguar XFR it was actually. And when we towed it out, we could see there was damage, but it was superficial damage. I remember the front splitter in carbon fibre was deformed and twisted and cracked. And so clearly a fair amount of damage financially had been done, but the car was drivable. So we called Aston Martin. Someone had to put in that very awkward phone call to the press office. Sorry, I've crashed your car.
Don't know what you mean. Never made one.
No. Well, I'm not sure I believe you there. But we explained that it was still drivable, and we still had a couple of things to do with it. So they said, okay, fine, don't worry about the car. It's all that matters is that you're okay. Carry on doing what you need to do, and we'll come and collect the car in a few days. Later on that evening, somebody else driving over a single track road in North Wales over moorland went over a humpback bridge a bit too fast, and the Aston ended up 50 metres off the road, so far away that it needed a farmer with a tractor to come and drag it back onto the road. And so that was the twice-crashed Aston Martin V12 Vantage. I think in the end, the second accident actually didn't do any more damage, so we pretended to Aston Martin that it was only the one incident.
So to be clear, you lot crashed the same car on the same day twice.
Twice.
Do you know, I think that's quite special, even by the legendary levels of incompetence of the Autocar road test team back in the day when I was running it. I don't think we ever managed to do that.
Yeah, I'm not mentioning any names because I think someone might be a bit embarrassed about that story. But it was, it was like these things always are, terrible at the time, but they very quickly become quite funny, don't they?
We did once crash three cars on the same corner at the same time. Yes, remind me at the start of the podcast to tell you the story of Black Monday. yes, that was another, but I've never done the same car twice.
Okay, well, yeah, hopefully that was a one-off. I think we both agree that the V12 Vantage, crashed or not, is one of the best Aston Martins ever. Let's flip it on its head, though, Andrew. And you'll have a much better sense of this than I will. The worst one ever?
Well, it's so tempting to say Signet, isn't it? Signet, they're actually quite expensive now. I couldn't believe it. You know how it is, particularly during lockdown. You're so bored. You just find yourself surfing through the classifieds or anything. And I found a Signet for sale for like 30 grand or something. I mean, it was just completely nuts. I'm not going to say Signet because it's not an Aston Martin and there's nothing that anyone can say which will convince me that it is. the worst one. There was one that I drove which... It was so bad. I mean, usually I'm pretty good at being objective about things and, you know, maybe being a bit disappointed, but this car was so bad, it actually really annoyed me. It almost made me angry, it was so bad, which was the automatic Virage Volante. Now, you were born, but you were barely born when the Virage came out. And this was a car... They claimed it to be a new car. It clearly wasn't. It was a development of the Vantage, you know. And underneath, you know, the Virage carried on in various forms. You know, the V600 Le Mans into the 21st century, and underneath it, you know, still lay the Superleggera technology that they pioneered the DB4 in 1959. So this was technology which was decades old. And they did the Virage on a budget of, I believe, £30 million for what they claimed to be an entirely new car. It had quite a good engine. Reeves Calloway in the US had put some 32 valve heads on the old V8. But the car itself was just hopeless. And then they went and chopped its roof off. And then they went and gave it a terrible automatic gearbox. And so what you had was a convertible Aston Martin, which didn't look particularly good. It sounded okay, but it was so slow it could barely get out of its own way. It was so badly built. And I can remember driving this thing away from the autocar office, you know, being increasingly sad about the entire thing, and eventually getting to wherever it was where I met somebody else. And I just gave them the keys and said, just you're driving this now. And I think it's probably the only time, Signet aside, that I've actually not wanted to drive an Aston Martin. How sad is that?
Wow. Well, okay, but that's fair enough. There aren't too many of those incidents from 107 years or something.
No, and that's the thing. So I'm sorry to butt in, but do you know what? If I look back, there've been okay. There probably haven't been that many Aston Martins which, hand on my heart, I can say, yeah, there's nothing. There's no Ferrari. There's no Porsche. There's no Bentley. There's no nothing which is better than that. But Aston Martins, they've always been really pretty good cars. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, I guess that they were cars which relied a bit too much on the name and the heritage and, you know, their sort of old-fashioned charm. But recently, you know, there haven't been any really clunky Aston Martins. You know, they mostly, almost all of them look really good. They've all had really good engines in them. You know, they've always handled well, you know, so, you know, they are good cars.
Well, there we go. I think we've spoken enough about the here and now and the past. But I think we should close this podcast by looking towards the future of Aston Martin. I mean, perhaps it looks a bit more secure now with the support of Lawrence Stroll and his backers, but it's still uncertain. Particularly with everything that's going on in the wider world. Even now, Andy Palmer, the CEO, talks about wanting to turn Aston Martin into the British Ferrari, which is as grand an ambition as it's possible to have for that sort of company. Ferrari is the company that builds 10,000 cars a year, close to $1 billion in profit, heritage unlike any other company. Do you think it's a realistic ambition for Palmer?
I think it so much depends on the interpretation. I mean, I've heard him quoted saying that. I don't know the context in which he said it and what exactly he meant by when he said it. I don't think that he means for Aston Martin to be a 10,000 car a year business anymore. I think clearly that was once an aspiration. I suspect that isn't exactly on the radar anymore. I think that what he means is a brand that is revered, like Ferrari is. And that's much less of a leap, because I think that despite all its travails, I think that Aston Martin is still a brand that is revered. But I take your point about Lawrence Stroll's money. I mean, goodness knows, it's welcome. But, you know, there has to be some more from somewhere. particularly with the timing of obviously this terrible virus couldn't have been worse for any car manufacturer. But again, you know, it just further exposes the vulnerability of a manufacturer like Aston Martin, which, you know, has its backers, but it doesn't have that one big parent company. And and I admire Andy Palmer and his determination to keep Aston Martin independent, which allows him to do his own thing, you know, to create his own platform for the DBX and that sort of thing. But, you know, I wonder, if I'm honest with you, in the future, whether that is will be perceived to be a sustainable model. You know, it'll be interesting to see what, you know, particularly what Geely does with Lotus, and whether there's someone out there. I mean, people obviously, because it has a 5% holding, have always talked about Daimler, you know, taking a big chunk of Aston Martin. You know, the executives at Mercedes that I've spoken to have always been very resistant to that idea and said, no, we're just a technology partner. But, you know, much as I admire Aston Martin, the board of Aston Martin's desire to keep it independent, I'm afraid there is a bit of me that if I heard that Mercedes-Benz had just taken a controlling interest, it would just breathe the most enormous sigh of relief. Because I think that's it. It's preserved. We don't have to worry about it anymore. They'll have the budget to create. I mean, really, in Aston Martin, it's just being held back because it's never really, apart from in the Ford days, and there were all sorts of issues with the Ford management back then, as we've touched on earlier, they've never really had the ability just to go and show what they can do in the same way that Volvo's done it under, you know, under Geely. I don't think anybody really realised what a Volvo could be. And obviously it's a completely different context, but nevertheless, they have absolutely shone because some proprietor has come along and said, okay, we trust you guys and we will continue to trust you until you, you know, mess it up. See what you can do. And I would just love someone to do that with Aston Martin and give it a proper budget, because I'm convinced that unlike, you know, so many brands out there, the currency that still lies latent within Aston Martin is one that could create amazing cars and secure it the stable future that has never been part of its past. But that's just me.
Do you think the world looks slightly different now, or will do 3 months from now, 6 months from now? And is it possible that this idea of bringing an SUV to market, chasing volume, will look like a mistake? Is it possible that Aston Martin should instead downsize and limit the number of cars it produces, become more exclusive?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this said before. I've seen people say you should can the DBX before the DBX. I don't subscribe to that. I mean, 4 years ago, when it was still something that perhaps could have been canned because not a huge amount of money had been spent on it, perhaps you could have done it. But, you know, they have engineered an entire new platform for it. They've built an entire new factory for it. The car is good to go. I've driven it, as you know. I've only driven it briefly, and a dog-eared prototype, you know, in the middle of the night in pouring rain in South Wales. So it wasn't exactly what you'd call an extensive test drive. But from what I've seen, you know, in that market, which still exists, it has, you know, it has a role to play. And, you know, without wishing to repeat myself, you know, the Porsche Cayenne is, you know, is a great example of how that kind of car can actually totally transform the fortunes of a small sports car manufacturer. Now, there are obviously issues, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the lack of a hybrid really does concern me. But if they can make the DBX work, then I can see an Aston Martin, where you have on the one side, you know, the SUV, or whatever replaces the SUVs in the future, you know, maybe the big electric saloon or whatever. And then on the other side, you have the, for want of a better word, thoroughbred Aston Martins, the Aston Martins that, you know, that we'd want to get in and drive. And I think with one providing the credibility for the other and the other providing the money for the first, then I think that's a viable way forward. That is what I would do. But who knows? It's going to be interesting. I hope it all works out for them, because I don't think anybody wants Aston Martin to go under. I don't think that it will, because, you know, 107 years later, you know, it's still here. And in my mind, as someone who's done a bit of research into it, however bad things are for Aston Martin right now, they've been a hell of a lot worse for them in the past.
Okay, so let's begin to wind this down then. A few months ago, I was so excited for Aston Martin. Partly for the cars that were coming, for its motorsport activities. And in the last few weeks, I think my enthusiasm, my optimism has been tempered slightly. But do you think that when we come through this, Aston Martin can still flourish and still grow to be this incredible brand that we're all very fond of again?
Very short answer. Yes, absolutely, it can. Whether it will, I'm afraid, remains to be seen. It needs very, very careful management. It needs to keep its ambitions under control. It needs to be very precise with what it does. It cannot, flash the cash anymore. Excessive spending on vanity projects. It needs to, pay its way. And then I think, because of the inherent value within the brand, I think it can grow and thrive and flourish, and be wonderful in the future. And I just hope that it does.
Yeah, you and I both. Andrew, any last words on Aston Martin?
Yeah, I'd like to go drive an Aston Martin. I'd like to go and drive anything, really. Any last words on Aston Martin? I hope they keep racing. I think racing is really, really important. Not so much Formula One. I understand why they're doing that. I would love to see the day come again when an Aston Martin could win Le Mans outright, and it saddens me. Again, I understand it entirely why they have withdrawn from the WEC hypercar category. Aston Martin say it's because the rules aren't clear. Le Mans says it's because Aston Martin's out of money. Whatever, but I'd like to see that. But but more than anything else, I just want to see it survive. I just want to see a clear strategy followed through, not too ambitious, but brave and confident. And I think if they do that, I think even now, definitely there's a way back for Aston Martin. Their cars are good. They make good cars. They have been undone by many factors beyond their control, one or two within their controls. But, hopefully this terrible situation we're in will go away. Obviously not many people are going to have a huge amount of money in the near future, which is why you have to be very modest with your ambitions going forward. But, over time, I can see a way back, definitely.
Well, there we go. We'll wrap it up there. And we haven't even mentioned 007. I think we'll have to do that in a separate podcast, Andrew. One for you to lead, I think.
I'll do my best. I may have a word or two to say on that subject.
Okay. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for your time. And everybody listening, thank you so much for taking the time to download the podcast and listen. Thank you, as ever, for your feedback. It means so much to us. Please remember to rate the podcast where you can and subscribe. Wherever you get your podcast from, do subscribe as well, please. It helps us. Hopefully it helps you to find the podcast as well. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back to talk to you again soon. Bye, everyone.
Cheers.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.